This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! The utility regulator John French in the Nolan Show studio today revealing that all this talk about compensation to NIE customers, it's about 25%, he reckons, of the NIE customer base. Well, guess who would pay for that? Every single customer of NIE in Northern Ireland. There would be a £7 to £15 extra charge put in the bill. So 100% of the customer base would fund the compo going out to 25% of the customers. Let's see if people are still calling for compensation after John has revealed that this morning. Lots of banter with some of our callers, different news stories, all in the mix of the Nolan Show this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. There may be shockwaves going through electricity customers this morning after they hear the regulator interview that we've just done today. Utility regulator in Northern Ireland is a man called John French, and he's come in to speak to me at length. And he's told the Nolan Show, if NIE do pay out compensation that Stormont is asking for, if we match the rules in Great Britain, that will lead to every electricity customer in Northern Ireland being charged for the compensation. So John reckons about 25% of the electric paying public would receive compensation, but every single one of you, 100% of electricity customers would have the charge put onto their bill to pay for the compensation to the 25%. It would not come out of NIE's profits if we match the model in Great Britain. Now, Stormont could decide to legislate so that NIE have to pay it, but John French is warning about the dangers of any knee-jerk decisions here. This is a wide-ranging interview with the regulator, who also reveals that he recommended Stormont look at legislation here in Northern Ireland being similar to Great Britain. But guess what? He put it in front of them in 2023. And guess what? Very little's happened since. The legislation isn't down. So questions again for the efficacy, for the efficiency of Stormont and how quickly they process things and put down legislation. And guess what? Stormont was down for some of that time. But the top line to this interview you're about to hear, for those people calling for compensation, those people who don't get compo, are they prepared for the 15 quid, 20 quid, 25 quid extra charge that would appear on their bill for the 25% of customers who would receive the compo? So this is John French, Chief Executive of the Utility Regulator. I began by asking him about what we're currently facing.
Nothing's happened like this since the 1960s. It is pretty distressing time at the moment.
And I think people are wanting to be represented.
Yes.
And you're part of that loop, aren't you? So what have you been doing?
So we've been working with NIE. We've been working with the department, trying to understand how they are restoring customers back to supply. And now we're starting the discussion around the compensation measures. So Minister Murphy wrote to us yesterday and wrote to NIE asking if we could work with his officials to try and build up a compensation scheme. So those meetings will start today.
And we'll get to the compensation in a second or two. But given the scale of this, are you content that NIE have worked as hard as they can, as fast as they can?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when you see the time and effort and you're speaking to people late at night, very early in the morning to see how the teams have come in, they're doing three shifts in terms of getting people on. You can see the numbers that are reconnecting every day. So yes, there'll be a wrap up at the end to see what things, how things can improve. But at the time, I don't think you can criticise NIE at all for the efforts they're putting in.
There are still some people without power,
yes,
and they're getting these automated messages. It'll be the 3rd of February. You know, I'm hearing from people, and this is just one example, in the Castlewellan and Tamara area, Clonvaron.
Yeah.
There's 6 days without power. There are whole families there without power, isolated, and all they're getting is a text response.
Yes, and look, my in-laws are out. They've got the text message that they'll get connected tomorrow. So know what it means, and you know they're pensioners in their 70s. So it is distressing in times of how you keep warm and one thing and another. It's the magnitude of this. Nothing's happened like this before in terms of the size, the scale. This is 25% of households here in Northern Ireland that have been affected. You know, this is a scale that's never been experienced before. Now, maybe you've got it at the wash-up session, look at how things are going forward, and maybe they need to be able to deal with that size of scale. But, you know, the size and scale is, it's 25% of all households here that are affected.
But that is one of the fundamental questions. Should they be able to cope with this size of scale? This could happen again. We're seeing more and more adverse weather, extreme weather events.
That's right.
Have they got to take more money out of their profits in the future to be able to cope with this better?
Well, it won't be out of their profits. This is a regulated market, so there'll be a regulated allowance that they will be able to do that. So it's a matter of seeing whether... You know, as you rightly say, going forward with climate change, is there going to be more storms? Do NIE need to have a bigger capacity?
What's your view on that?
Look, this is a, you know, I've been working in Northern Ireland on this for 15, 16 years. There's never been something of this scale before. You know, I think we need to look forward. The amount of storm events are increasing, so we might need to look at things going forward. But
need to look at what? Their capacity to deal with this better.
Yeah, everything at the moment. So as a regulator, what we would do would benchmark against all other companies. So we benchmark against Irish companies, we benchmark against British companies, and we'd see the size and scale they're working through. So, you know, I guess we just... This is an emerging thing. This hasn't happened before to this length. We had storms a few weeks ago and there was thousands of people off supply. But to the magnitude that we've had of, 25% of households off, you know, that's never happened before since the 60s.
So how do we compare to other countries?
We benchmark correctly, you know. So NIE do a good job. But there's always things that they can learn. You know, everyone can get better. So, you know, no one should be resting on their laurels here.
And what quite literally, look, I mentioned that Clonvaron example where people are telling me they're being told to go to their friends and their family, yes. But their friends and their family live in the same area. So, like, what literally do those people do? Well, in the pitch darkness, in the freezing cold, unable to cook?
Well, there's community centres that have been set up around. So I can speak from personal experience about the Ballymoney area. So the Joey Dunlop centres there, my in-laws are going there, charging up their phones, getting hot water and, you know, using the shower facilities there. I'm not quite sure about the Castlewellan, but I'm sure if you look on the website, there will be a local community centre that they can do something. Far from ideal, I know. But
yeah. And how do you get to it? If you're a mobile, you don't have transport, you can't afford it.
Well, this brings back to another issue in terms of medical care registers. You know, if people are struggling, there's not people in Northern Ireland are reticent about signing up to medical care registers. So we probably think only 10% of the people that are due to be on the medical register should be there. Please do sign up to that medical register. That enables the likes of NIE, Northern Ireland Water, all the gas companies, when there is a problem, to look for you personally and find you out and make sure you're prioritised. So I'd really encourage people who haven't, and I heard on your radio show yesterday, there was a lady who said she hadn't signed up to it. Please do sign up to it.
Is that the lady that was struggling to breathe with
yes,
COPD?
Yes, exactly.
She can't get power into her nebulizer.
Exactly.
It was deeply distressing, wasn't it?
But that Northern Ireland Electricity need to know about that. So, you know, somebody like that absolutely should be on a care register. So please do ring up NIE and make sure you're registered for that.
Let's talk about compensation,
sure.
John, because we have this situation. If you're listening to History's Nolan Show, you'll know the approach I'm taking, which is just wondering how come yet again it is Northern Ireland compared to the rest of the UK where consumers' rights seem to be less protected. So everywhere else in the UK, they're entitled to compensation. Lo and behold, not here. Mm-hmm. Why not here?
Well, it comes back down to legislation. So regulations are based on legislation. So GB brought forward legislation in 2005 that brought forward, that allowed the regulator there, Ofgem, to build a scheme around storm damage. So unfortunately, we don't have that legislation at the moment. So there's been updates of that legislation in GB.
But that's not unfortunate. And by the way, it's not your fault.
Yeah, sorry.
But it's deliberate. Our politicians deliberately, they must have, they couldn't, you can't change legislation everywhere else in the UK. We've got MPs.
Yes.
Our politicians deliberately didn't get it changed. Why not?
Well, I wasn't there in 2005, but we've been discussing this. So we brought a consultation forward 2023, recognising the differences between GB and Northern Ireland.
As the regulator, you did that.
We brought that forward. But the problem is it then becomes a legislative issue. So we need the department to come and change the legislation. So we can recognise the problem, but we cannot bring forward the legislation. And I'm not just being a bureaucrat on this. You know, we as a regulator implement legislation. We don't bring legislation.
So did you recommend in 2023 that the legislation be changed?
We've been in discussion with the department about there is elements of consumer protection that Northern Ireland doesn't have. And we would like to see that brought forward, that we're on the similar basis to what's in Great Britain at the moment.
What response did you get from them?
Well, they're looking to bring forward legislation, but it's fine. It's drafting it and bringing it forward through the Stormont Assembly and things like that.
But that's what government is.
So we just need to work with them and try and see if this can move forward. But there is...
And I understand why you might need to be, you know, slightly careful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to be. So you bring legislation to Stormont in 2023 to protect consumers.
No, just to be clear.
You bring a recommendation.
We did a consultation, right. Recognised...
And so for 2 years, Stormont's done nothing. Is that accurate? Have they done anything? Has it moved on?
Well, nothing's come through the legislative powers, but...
Why not?
Well, it needs to be drafted and brought through.
So they haven't done it?
They recognise, to be fair to them, they recognise the issue, but it's just bringing it through. And drafting the process, yeah. There's legislation there in GB and everything, yeah.
And I know why you have to have a relationship, but you're an arm's length regulator.
Yes.
Is it acceptable? What you brought forward in 2023, has Stormont done enough since then? Your arm's length. You work for us, the public.
Yes, we do.
Is it acceptable?
We believe consumers in Northern Ireland should have the same protection as consumers in Great Britain. Yeah.
But I'm just going to ask you one more time.
Uh-huh.
On behalf of all of those people listening, and they pay your wages, the politicians don't.
Yes.
Has Stormont been too slow to look at what you recommended in 2023, and are people now suffering because of it?
Well, you know, it's hard to answer that directly because I know what's happening behind this. There's work going on behind the scenes to bring energy legislation forward. But at the current moment in time, we don't have the same protection as consumers in Great Britain.
I think your hesitancy in how you are answering it is answering it. So I'll move on. Look, if the compensation were to be in place similar to across the water, tell us how that would work for us in the future.
So what happens in Great Britain is Ofgem are our opposite number in England, Scotland, Wales. They've been given the statutory powers to take this forward. So within what's known as a price control process, they allow companies like NIE, Scottish Power, and one thing and another to undertake a compensation scheme. Now, that's compensation scheme isn't from their profits. That's run through the price control process. So NIE are given an allowance and allowed to take that money. Sorry, the Scottish companies or the Welsh or the English companies are allowed, if there's a storm damage, to take monies through the network charges of consumers in England, Scotland and Wales to pay for that compensation.
So the public get compensated and then the public pay for it themselves.
That's right.
How? It's put onto their bills?
It's put onto their network charges, which make up about 20-30% of a consumer's bill. So if you were to run a similar scheme here in Northern Ireland, based on what Ofgem was saying, you'd be adding 1-2% on consumers' bills.
Every consumer pays for...
This storm event, you'd be looking to be adding £7 to £15 on somebody's bill to pay for the compensation to the rates that Ofgem pay on Northern Ireland. And that's because it's just pure economics that you're looking that 25% of consumers have been affected by it, where in Scotland and Wales with this storm event in Northumbria, there's 1-2% of the overall consumer. So the overall consumers in GB are paying for 1-2% of households in compensation. If we were to run a similar scheme here in Northern Ireland, we'd be looking to compensate a quarter of all households.
So 100% of all paying households would have their electricity bill increased by about £10 to £15 to pay 25% of households the compensation.
That's right. And that's what happens in the GB scheme. Yeah. So if we were to replicate that in Northern Ireland, that's what you'd be looking for.
So why is it set up like that? That if I look at NIE, they had 70 odd million of pre-tax profits 2023. Why is it not come out of their profits? Sometimes they have good years, sometimes they have a bad year. Why is that not acceptable?
So what you have with companies is a regulatory contract. So each company is set up in Northern Ireland, gas, electricity, water. They have a regulatory contract. And that's meant to be a very stable investment environment that allows them to go forward. So it's kind of the rules of the game that it allows. So if NIE wanted to put their hand in the pocket, that's up to them. But
should they, John?
Well, it's up to England. You know, in England, Scotland, Wales, they don't put their hands in the pocket. The consumer pays for it through. That's up to NIE. If they, you know.
But my question to you, our regulator.
Yes.
You're not their spokesperson. You're our regulator.
Yes.
In this specific incident, and you've seen the distress, you've heard it on the Nolan Show, you've seen it elsewhere. Should NIE be putting their hand in their own pockets in this isolated incident as a gesture?
And I'm going to
dodge. Michelle and Emma are asking.
Yes, I know they are. Well,
First and Deputy First Minister.
That would be a political conversation between the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister with NIE. My rules of the game are that I have to regulate them through a regulatory licence, and there's no mechanism to do that. If NIE want to do that outside the mechanism, that's up to them.
Should they?
Well, that's really a question you'd have to ask NIE themselves, you know, in terms of...
Well, I can't ask NIE, does the regulator think that they should? I'm asking the regulator.
I don't think they should within the rules of the game.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And thank you for asking that. Given the fact that we don't, for answering that, given the fact that we don't, John, have the legislation in place here that consumers are entitled to that compensation,
yes.
Could we take advantage of that in that has Stormont got the power to draft new legislation for Northern Ireland,
yes,
which would be different than across the water, which would force the NIE to take it out of their profits? Could Stormont decide whether to do that or not?
Absolutely. That's their prerogative. The only thing you've got to be careful is we've asked, I'm not wanting to sound apologetic for NIE, we've asked NIE to develop its network. We've asked them to invest £2.2 billion over the next 6 years to make sure the network can meet the net zero target. So it's a robust network. What that profit that they're doing isn't going back to shareholders. What it's doing is financing the loans that they're using to borrow to invest on that £2.2 billion. So if you start playing around sometimes with this, you might find out that Northern Ireland pays a higher cost for their energy overall because we still got to meet our net zero targets. We've still got to invest in the network. So you're double counting. So Why I'm a bit hesitant is because, you know, if you make shotgun decisions around this, you could end up with higher costs for consumers. So just ultimately, as a regulator, we're always looking to make sure the cheapest price. Might sound bureaucratic, it might sound academic, but it's trying to look, weigh the different things up to make sure that we're getting the best price for consumers. And sometimes if you upset the apple cart, you might have consequences through that.
Or we might find a different supplier.
No, NIE aren't the supplier. They're the network operator.
We might find a different network operator, no? Or have they got us by the short term?
Well, it's a monopoly.
It's a monopoly.
Yeah.
So that's even more reason why we need to be careful that we're protected, isn't it?
And that's the role of the regulator. We act as that competition to make sure that...
You see, I'm learning from you today all of this conversation that there's been in the news cycle about compensation, and I didn't know, and I'm pretty sure quite a few other people didn't know, well, actually, if Northern Ireland consumers get that compensation, they're paying for it themselves. It's not coming. So I'm learning that today. And I'm just remembering what the NIE managing director, because I played the clip yesterday and we'll play it again this morning. He told Evening Extra they would be looking at a scheme similar to Across the Water.
Yes.
And the scheme similar across the water is that it's the consumers who pay for the compensation.
That's right. That's right. So there's only three ways you can pay for it. It's either through government money, it's through NIE taking it out of their own pocket, or it's through consumers. Now, it might be a mixture of the three, but they're basically the only ways it can be paid for.
So do we need to tread carefully here around the compensation talk in case it ends up costing everybody more?
I think we need to be realistic about what we're saying. And I think we need to be realistic in the timescales. You know, you might recall the cost of living crisis where everyone got 600 quid in terms of that. That took 3 to 4 months to develop, you know. So even if there was a decision today to, you know, pay it and what the levels were going to be, unfortunately, consumers aren't going to get it by the end of next week. It's going to take a system to work out how it's paid and move through.
Are you involved in the conversations at the moment with NIE and government about compensation?
So we've had conversations. We're hoping to have a more detailed conversation today. So there's working level discussions today to try and work that up. But as I say, it's working that through. It's working out where the money is coming from. If it is from network charges, that's going to add, you know, between 7 and 15 quid on everyone's bill on a year. You know, what is, you know, is government going to support it? Is UK government going to support it? You know, where is the money going to come from? And there's all legislative problems around this. So regulation, unfortunately, is slow and steady and steadfast in its approach. You know, we just need to make careful if we're doing things quickly that we're not making mistakes for the long term and we're not setting precedents that we can't afford.
Okay. It's been really helpful today and thank you for coming in. Have you a final message to the general public and indeed to our politicians learning about this as we go along? What is your message to all of us, John, our regulator?
First and foremost, we want customers, you know, really worried about the most vulnerable customers out there. So if you are vulnerable, please get yourself on a consumer register and make sure your company knows that you've got the issues that you have so they can support you.
Does that entitle you to anything immediately?
Yes, you're prioritised. So in terms of when NIE are reconnecting you or there's a gas problem or water problem, you will get prioritised in that process. And, you know, people have been talking about generators. You know, you might end up with the generator that supports you. So it's vitally important that consumers contact NIE and make them aware of the difficulties they're having.
Just when you mention generators, I know that Stormont were bringing in another 300 generators. Mm-hmm. Do we need to look at how many we have in stock? Mitigating against a future event?
Well, that goes back to what I said at the start. You know, we need to look through this and see what lessons are to be learned. But there's a mutual aid support with GB Islands to support on that. I think we saw photographs yesterday of companies coming in from Jersey to help and Norway. So there is that international support. But yes, there needs to be a lessons learned exercise after this event.
John, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir. Here's Stephen. Morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning. Well, the contribution by the regulator, I think, has just completed a circle here. Because when you think about where the idea came from to ask Northern Ireland Electricity to hand out payments. It came from the First and the Deputy First Minister. These are the people who run our executive. And obviously, they aren't prepared to admit that the Stormont photocopier has been broken for years. The Stormont photocopier, of course, is that which would have given the people of Northern Ireland the same protections as those in England and Wales and elsewhere through proper regulation.
Do you think it's fair that the that 100% of NIE customers, if we follow the model in Great Britain, would be charged so that there is a pot of money to pay compensation to those people who are entitled to it? So it wouldn't come out of NIE profits. The executive wouldn't cover the cost. The regulator is saying £7 to £15 of an extra charge would be put on everybody's bill. But not everybody's getting the compo, obviously.
You see, as ever, Stephen, for this place, it's too little and it's too late. If they'd followed the model that had been provided across the water, they may have built up, if you like, some funds to be able to put this into effect. But to not have done, this is the politicians we're talking about here, who have failed to act to represent the people. Okay, so, no, it's not fair, because Northern Ireland Electricity, as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, is a company who provide power, but that power supplier is owned by the Republic of Ireland. Okay? And to ask you know, people who buy product, the electricity, to pay so that Stormont are hidden from their failures, I think is beyond a joke.
Let's just play what the managing director of NIE told Evening Extra. This would have been 2 days ago now. Let's just listen to this again with the context of what the regulator has told us this morning.
Yeah, exactly. So the rules in GB were changed around those guaranteed standards a number of years ago. So what we would like to do is implement something similar in Northern Ireland to reflect the changes that have happened around those guaranteed standards, so that people have certainty around what their expectations are in the event of a storm or in the event of significant disruption to electricity.
So if you listen carefully now, with the context of what the regulator said, listen to what the managing director, I can't remember his name, said, Derek Hines, that they would like to implement something similar. Does that mean that essentially they're saying, sure, we'll issue compensation, but it'll be similar to GB, won't come out of our profits. It will be every NIE customer with an extra charge. Regulator reckons it's £7 to £15. We've learned that today on everybody's bill. Peter in Guildford. Morning, Peter.
Good morning, Stephen. I got a flyer here on Monday morning, and it says that I'm paying £30 of a standing order every monthly. I've got a thing saying that it's going to be £45 a month now. I wonder if I pay for their mistakes.
Well, what mistakes? Nobody could control the weather.
But they could control taking down these trees along the road and hanging over the wires and big boughs and branches, you know what I mean? Yeah. People should be made to cut them. Another thing, if the Northern Ireland storm didn't follow the rules of England and Scotland, how come Gordon Lyons could follow the rules and take away the fuel payments to a year when we most needed it?
Well, we would have had to have paid for a whole system from our budgets and all of that. The bottom line is this. The bottom line is that will there be a change now in the conversation, the public conversation, now that we're learning that actually it would be us paying for the compo, not NIE? Now, again, the regulator said, yeah, Stormont could legislate to make NIE pay for it, but beware, be careful, because they've got a monopoly. And what would that do eventually to the rest of our bills?
Martin in North Belfast. Martin, morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Stay there 1 second for me. We'll take the news. We'll be straight back to you. Go ahead, Martin. Morning to you. Go ahead, sir.
Good morning, Stephen. It's just a simple point. It seems with all this adverse weather and we're expecting more to come in the future, why don't you put the cables underground? They think they do that in parts of the South.
Well, what's that cost?
Well, how much is it going to cost in the end of the day and the inconvenience and the health risk to people depending on electric to stay away?
Well, listen, there's...
How much is that going to cost?
Yeah, it's a fair question. But all of this, if we're trying to future-proof against the... Like, we can't even get the potholes fixed, for goodness sake, that there currently are. We don't have enough money for...
Well, this place is going to hell in a handcart, as far as I'm concerned, the way the politicians are on it. But it's a simple solution. Do you know what I mean? If you have no cables to blow down or fall down, or telegraph poles or pylons to fix, and they're underground, at the end of the day, that's got to be an economic solution, and with a less of a risk to life.
Let me ask you the question. Now that you learned this morning that it would be you, whether you receive compensation or not, the compensation pot paid out to about 25% of the NIE customer base, it would be paid for by a charge being put on everybody's electric bill. Do you think that will change the compensation? Do you think some people will say, well, if I'm not getting it, I'm not paying for it?
Well, I ask you a question in return. How can that be compensation if I'm paying for it?
What do you mean?
Well, if I'm paying for it on my bill, out of my pocket, and it's to compensate a loss, I'm paying for my own loss.
And those people who aren't getting any money are also paying for your loss.
Well, there you go. I think the system's wrong.
Well, let's see. We'll ask the executive. We'll ask the Office of First and Deputy First Minister. They've recommended that NIE pay out. Are they recommending that that payout is done similar to the rules in GB, which means you're all charged for it? And we'll try to establish what Michelle O'Neill, our First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly, our Deputy First Minister's view is on that. Did they know that when they were on the news bulletins yesterday giving that press conference saying compo should be paid? Did they know that the cost of the compo was coming out of everybody's pocket? Are they happy with that? Maybe they are. Maybe they think we should all dig in. So let's see what they say. 030 30 80 55 55. I want to move on. The police ombudsman has found an officer did not act with sensitivity when he intervened at a Troubles memorial event during COVID restrictions. The incident took place outside the Sean Graham Bookmakers on the Armour Road in Belfast 2021. People had gathered to mark the 29th anniversary of the murders of five people in a loyalist gun attack. Now, the Ombudsman, Marie Anderson, has decided, she investigated a complaint for Mark Sykes, a survivor of the attack, who was arrested and put into handcuffs. He was released 90 minutes later. Marie Anderson has decided that she is of the view that, quote, the arresting officer had not responded in line with an order to treat the gathering with sensitivity. Former senior police officer John Burrows with us today. Morning, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the Belfast Telegraph's crime correspondent, Alison Morris. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you both again. John, these officers were required to act with sensitivity. I think, unless this is explained, this presents us with even more questions than answers now. How do you define sensitivity when you're making an arrest? And does this now need to apply to everybody who is being arrested who has any type of connection with the Troubles in the past?
You ask pertinent questions, and I'll first of all say that this is a total nonsense what's being reported. The first thing to really clarify here is the Ombudsman put these allegations to the police officer in a police misconduct proceedings, not following a lawful order to treat this matter with sensitivity. There was a handcuffing issue that she raised and one other issue. They were completely overturned on the 31st of May 2024, and the officer was found to have committed no misconduct whatsoever. And I can tell you, Stephen, I have watched the video and listened to everything about 30 times. I put my right hand the Bible and swore in court. The officer did nothing insensitive. Another point I want to make just at the outset is this idea that he didn't treat the memorial with sensitivity. He waited until it was over. We're still talking about that the officers intervened. The judge covered this. I've covered it many times. It was over by more than 5 minutes. Everyone had left. The street had reopened. The flowers were lifted. The PA equipment was gone. And the officers were called over. And then a confrontation took place. And they were relentlessly sensitive. They were compliant. And they did everything professional. And that's why...
Well, not according to the police ombudsman.
Well, her allegation was disproven in a police disciplinary process. And let's just give a timeline, of course. The officer was suspended at a dusk press conference when the chief constable said something happened so alarming that he required to suspend them. And yet, as I said at the time, they would be proven innocent. And here's the, can I just give this statement? The PPS looked at it and found no crime. The High Court looked at it and said, actually, the officers are the victim of a lawful suspension. The police disciplinary process looked at it and said the officers are completely innocent. So they are innocent. And I'm afraid I just disagree with Mary Anderson. I don't know what she's found insensitive.
Alison?
I think that the Ombudsman's findings are very useful in terms of how we go forward, because, I mean, I know that John has said this numerous times, but there's nobody could watch those videos of what happened that day and say that that was good policing. It just wasn't good policing. Had that been a memorial to the victims of Le Mans or the Shankill bomb or anyone paying the respects, and we see someone who was injured in those attacks being dragged off and handcuffed, there would have been equal outrage from politicians on the other side, and rightly so. The fact is that this was... You know, we look back with hindsight now, but even at that time, and I kept saying, as did others, that the policing of the COVID regulations in itself was a problem and a damage to the image of policing, because it was never a policing matter, it was a health matter. And the fact that police officers were policing an outside memorial where people were standing outside and of no risk to themselves or anyone else was in itself an issue. But leaving that aside, the fact that one of the people who was so badly injured in that attack was dragged off and handcuffed looked terrible. It was terrible for the image of policing, and it ultimately, this entire incident was so badly handled that, as John knows, it ended with the resignation of the chief constable after Justice Schofield's very damning report of his handling of the whole event. So this thing was, you know, a stain, I suppose, on the image of policing at the time. Not long after that, the Belfast Telegraph did a survey of our readers, and we could see that the image of policing and confidence in policing was at an all-time low. It did cause damage to the image of policing, and therefore her recommendations, they're not, I've seen stronger recommendations, they're sensible. It is that officers, probationary officers, should be trained to know when they're policing a certain area if there was a huge troubles event or something that they need to be aware of on that day.
Can I just come back on that? Right. I said at the outset that the PSNI ought to have known there was a memorial and that they should be tracking memorials. Right, it wasn't the officer's fault that he wasn't briefed about the memorial. He came across the memorial and asked for directions and was given them to monitor it until it finished, which he did. My point is there's lessons to be learnt, but the officer did no wrong. He was suspended unlawfully. He's still having his character tarnished by saying he acted insensitively. That is incorrect. And
well, you know, it's a matter of opinion rather than being actually incorrect.
Well, the Ombudsman, here's what the Ombudsman did. They sent a file to the PPS. The PPS said there's no crime. They sent a file to the Professional Standards Department with three recommendations for charges. They took place through the misconduct processes, and the officer was found not guilty of all of them. That's the fact. And I promise you, this officer, and I put my reputation on it, right? I understand what Alison said about the image. That should have been explained. What actually should have happened was Chief Constable should have come out and said, actually, we didn't know this memorial was taking place. We would have communicated in advance. The families normally tell the police, by the way, about this annual commemoration. For some reason that year, they didn't, as far as I'm aware. There was a miscommunication between those two individuals. But the fact that two young constables are out on their own, come across it, seek direction, and then try and make an arrest, it's not their fault.
But this has all been discussed. Can I zone in once again on the, you know, what the media is going with, this headline of this officer, and this is coming from the police ombudsman, did not treat the gathering with sensitivity. So in what way, Alison, should that officer have behaved? What does sensitivity mean to any troubles victim?
Look, I think that at the point when they arrived, they thought that it was a protest and they thought it was something that they had to then deal with. They rang through. There was a check made and a come back and said, that's a commemoration. I think that the problem then was the senior officer said, monitor the commemoration aqua sensitivity. At that point, he should have said, that's a commemoration. Just leave, move on, go on about your day.
Well, they weren't told to move on.
There was no criminal offence taking place. They weren't. And you see, that's the reason why there were seven other people were investigated by the Ombudsman as well, because they weren't acting unilaterally that day.
And Marie Anderson has issued no criticism about any of those other officers, which is why I'm concentrating on the officer who does have a criticism against him. Everybody in that 6,000 odd police force now will know who that officer is. So he is being labelled as someone who does not treat the public with sensitivity. What should he have done?
Well, it was not sensitive because someone was hawked off in handcuffs. It was later released an hour and a half later because they shouldn't have been detained. That was not sensitive. And at that point in time, the sensitive thing to do was to leave. That was the most
police ombudsman
thing to do,
did
to say,
not.
This is not a policing matter, I'm leaving.
But the police.
And leave the area.
Well, if it was not a policing matter, then it's not the fault, surely, of the police officer who was told to gather footage. So how do you gather footage? How are you acting with orders, consistent with the orders you're being given by a superior officer if you leave? He was told to gather footage.
As John will know, they were already there for some considerable time before this. The footage was gathered. There was no need to remain on the scene any longer after that.
That's not consistent with the detail. Alison.
The sensitivity issue is what I can say is, and that is one of the recommendations of the Ombudsman, which make common sense, is you do have young probationary officers. They were grown up in peace. I think one of them was from the south of Ireland. There's no way that we can expect that everyone wakes up in the morning and knows, look, someone died or there was a bomb went off on this date, the area that I'm policing. So they have to be told. And that was one of the failings, and I think it's a common sense recommendation.
Correct.
Of the Ombudsman, that if an officer, especially a young person in their 20s, is being sent out somewhere, that morning, before they're sent out, they go, bear in mind, there was a bomb went off in this area, there was 5 people killed, there were 7 people shot. Before you go out here, you know, there might be tensions, might be high, behave with sensitivity. And that should have been their order from the start. When they came across that, whoever was in the control room should have said, it's the anniversary of the Orma attack. That's where they're standing. Move on, that's fine.
But what Marie Anderson's report actually says is, given confirmation of the commemoration, in other words, after the officers knew there was a commemoration, so the discussion about they're young and they might not have known what it was, she is zoning in on the fact that after they knew about the commemoration, the supervising inspector then instructed the officers to still get footage but treat with sensitivity. So they were ordered to remain at the scene. I'm still labouring the point. How should that officer have behaved? What does she mean by sensitivity? And look, has Marie Anderson been, and has any of the rest of us who are listening to this programme, been in high tension situations where we're expected to act with sensitivity? What does it mean?
And an interesting point, Stephen, is the there's further radio transmissions. I've listened to them all. The officers then said, told after the memorial's finished, try and speak to the organisers, which he does, after everyone's left, which he does, and we need to get their details so we can follow it up sensitively in the future through a post-incident investigation. That's what he does. And when he asks someone their name in order to report them for the offence and be able to follow this up, an organiser to follow it up, it's refused. And actually for an hour he asked the person his name, both outside the police car and inside the police car, and it's refused. Always polite. And there's no insensitivity.
Yeah, but John, why was this man left with his hand? Why was Mr. Sykes left with his hands behind his back, handcuffed, behind his back for an hour and a half? Like, why?
I'll tell you why for an hour and a half. The officers were in Musgrave Police Station within 12 minutes. The reason he sat in the back of a police car for an hour and a half was there was negotiations between, I'll not mention names, senior politicians and senior PSNI officers. He was at the police station in 12 minutes. The officers were then told, wait, there's phone calls taking place from above. That's why he spent an hour and a half in the police car. Because the police officers were told, we're negotiating
this. I have literally, with my own eyes, recently seen police officers who arrest someone at that moment and minutes later, they assess the situation and they either bring someone's hands round to the front and handcuff them or they take the handcuffs off
off completely. But it kind of comes back that Marie Anderson has left us all guessing what she means by sensitivity.
Which is
what
unfair.
Does she mean? What is it? What is it? Could she define it?
Handcuffing point. The handcuffing was again an issue that went through the police misconduct process, and he was found not guilty. And also the PPS said there was no issue. An expert witness for the police who was used to train people in handcuffing said the handcuffing was consistent with everything. So I don't know what the insensitivity is, but you cannot defend yourself if there's not a clear charge.
Alison, for the rest of the young constables and indeed older police officers now who continue to police Northern Ireland, how do we learn from this if they also don't know? If you take about the amount of people that died in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, what is it, 3,500 people? There are many, many people, much more than that, who have been affected by the Troubles. So how do those officers understand how they treat victims of the Troubles sensitively if they don't know the details of what the police ombudsman had a problem with here?
Well, I think it's very specific to the fact that this was a commemoration, that there was no allegation that any laws were being broken. It was an outside event that was taking place in a, you know, restricted area. Usually there's a huge commemoration into the Ormore every year. This was just family who came to lay flowers. They were socially distanced. It had been placed on Facebook weeks before, I think a week before, 10 days before, said to people, look, don't come along to this. This isn't a public event. This is just a family flower wreath-laying. So the police should have been aware of that. They weren't. That's fine. I accept that those two officers didn't know anything about it. But the thing is, if you're policing any kind of commemoration, the minute they knew it was a commemoration, we could take about whose fault it was or wasn't. Should the senior officers have that said, that's a normal commemoration, get back in the car, away you go about your day. In my opinion, yes, they should have, but they didn't. They were told then to stay. And what we've seen was a very bad-tempered interaction between the police and people who were victims of that Ormo Sean Graham shooting. And that is where the problem arose. And anyone who has watched that, and albeit John has seen the entire footage, and I accept that, and we have seen what was filmed on people's phones, which was terrible for the image of policing. It looked really insensitive. It looked like bad policing. It looked like heavy-handed policing. Okay. And that is the image that people took from that footage.
I'm doubling down on the question, Alison, not to be frustrating, but I think it's really important. Genuinely do. So for those police officers currently policing today, if they come upon any individual who is genuinely traumatised by the Troubles, how do they treat that differently? Because this is, they're being asked to treat people with who have been victims of the Troubles with sensitivity. Now, I would have thought everybody should be treated with sensitivity, but I understand what it must be, why you would put an extra layer to those people
that
who've been traumatised.
That wasn't my reason.
So
of it.
How
my
do they police
it,
this? What do they do?
My reading of it wasn't that you know, if someone is a... Because we do have people who were victims of the Troubles who have went on to commit crimes and go to prison. You know, it's not to say that anyone who's a victim of the Troubles can't be policed. What it was saying is, if you come across a commemoration or you're likely to meet someone on a specific day where tensions are particularly high because there was an attack, and people, you know, sometimes we know they're suffering from PTSD, they're traumatised, they're not going to behave in a rational way, well then they should be trained how to behave around that, or not to behave around it at all, to withdraw from that and not be in that situation, unless there's a crime being committed. There is sensitivity here that could have been recognised at the time. You know, we know that there was a series of failings, but we do have an entirely new police executive team now, and you would hope that if a similar situation arose, it would be treated very differently.
Why do you think Alison Marie Anderson hasn't spelt out what she meant by the insensitive approach of this police officer, in her opinion? Why has she just left it vague?
I think that it would be handy if that police ombudsman report had more detail in relation to the recommendations of what she believes should have been handled differently. Instead, we have three quite short recommendations, two of which have been accepted by the police and one of which has been partially accepted. That was the one that was partially accepted was just to do with the fact that there were so many probationary and temporary officers on at that time, and that was just a problem that existed of that era. The other one was in relation to the officers being trained if they were going out to a certain area, so that they would know that if there had been a huge event happened that day, that they'd be aware of that. And so that had been accepted by the police. So it would be handy to have maybe more detail in some of those ombudsman reports. And listen, I deal with ombudsman reports quite a lot, and there's times when you do think there should be at least more detail or more background or something to this where I could assess the sort of context of it, and there's not. So maybe there should be. But at the same time, too, I think that sensitivity is a word that we all know what it means. It means that you know behave sensitively around someone, you know, not heavy-handed, not shouting, not screaming, not handcuffing people and putting them in the back of cars for, you know, for attending a commemoration. That, I think, is basic sensitivity, and it's common sense, and you don't think anyone really needs that explained to them.
Marie Anderson says, John, initial engagement captured by the officer's body-worn video cameras involved a verbal exchange with a man during which he commented about the way in which an incident had been policed at Pitt Park in East Belfast a number of days earlier on the 2nd of February. The exchange at this point, like the radio transmission, suggested that the officers were not aware of the significance of the commemoration. Body-worn videos subsequently showed that the man became more unsettled with police and swore at them, prompting one police officer to ask for his personal details, which he did not provide. The officer attempted to detain the man, who walked away.
And that's correct. He wouldn't give his details. They tried to detain the man. And actually, the irony in all this is the police were called over by that individual. He says, come over here. I want to know why you're here and not at Pitt Park. Because we know, and it didn't look good, that the police evidence gathered at Pitt Park when this sort of crowd of masked men walked past. But that wasn't the young officer's fault. And he actually said, look, I'm from a different policing area. I'm just here to look at a prima facie. What we're concerned about is a breach of COVID, because there was 30-odd people there. And then the individual became what the officer believed was disorderly. He asked for his details. He refused to give them, and then he tried to arrest him. And then a melee started. And I'm not going to be prejudicial to anyone by mentioning names and things. I'll just tell you what I saw. I saw police officers being subjected to sectarian abuse. I saw an officer being what I thought was hit in the face. I saw a crowd coming back and linking arms to prevent a
man. That's important that we're not levelling this against the man who was arrested. It's important
not at all.
To say that.
I'm just talking generally.
We are not doing that. Absolutely.
Of dozens of people there, right? He you know.
Let's not talk about Mr. Sykes. It wouldn't be fair to do
so. I haven't mentioned his name. Yeah. So I'm just describing what I saw from other people who I'll not mention, right? Linked arms, whenever the officer said that man's under arrest, some people linked arms to prevent the officer getting to that man. The officers were jostled, abused, and shouted at. And it was actually really hairy. I'll say that. I've watched it. I thought, my word. And they didn't take a baton out. They didn't use force. And they spent about 10 minutes trying to effect an arrest. And I can promise you, if that video footage came out, it would be very damaging to those who made a lot of allegations against the police officers.
Alison.
The thing about it is, and it's been said 100 times, is Mark Sykes is to this date the only person who's been arrested in connection with the Armour Road, the Sean Graham bookmaker's attack. You could see how tensions would be high when they see police basically gathering evidence against them for laying flowers, and that's where the problem was. And I agree that senior officers should have said, that's enough, you know, we know what it is now, that's okay, it's Sean Graham's commemoration, get in your car and go away, you go about your day and look for actual real crime to investigate. They didn't, and at that point we do know what happened in Pitt Park, and again the image of policing wasn't great after that either. And Mark Sykes is incredibly well known. He's someone who's interviewed numerous times in the papers, and the senior officers, had they watched the body worn camera, would have said that's Mark Sykes, and if there had been any allegations that anything had happened, they could have went and spoke to him later, which is what they did in Pitt Park. They stood and then there was arrest midweeks later after that. So if there was any allegations, they could have been properly investigated instead of all that was done on the day, which was completely uncalled for, and was really insensitive to those families. And we have to remember, you know, 5 people were murdered, including a 15-year-old child, and to this day nobody has ever been convicted of that, and there was another ombudsman report in relation to that. So this just wasn't, I don't think, regardless of what John Burrow says, I don't think it would be a good day for policing.
I know it's a different country, a different set of rules, but what the police force does, of course, in America, for example, is they release the footage. And I just wonder whether this footage will ever reach the public domain. But let's see. John, thank you. Alison, thank you. BBC Sounds, what a little tool. You can download it onto your mobile phone, tune into the Nolan Show, or fast forward through me if you want to. Why not download it and see how you get on? Austin's in Warren Point. Morning, Austin.
Morning, Stephen. Good to have you back.
Thank you very much indeed. I'd say it's nice to be back, except I was running around in shorts and a wee tight T-shirt. I bought a wee silver chain and I was running around carefree in America. Back to the freezing cold.
That's it. That's what happens. I'll tell you what it is, Stephen. You had a caller on, or you had a person on that with you this morning saying that 100% of the people in Northern Ireland might have to pay £25 for this compensation scheme.
So it's not £25, Austin, right? So what it is, and I think I got mixed up on that too. So what this is, the regulator, John French, what he's saying is, look, about 25%, not pounds, 25% of the NIE customer base would be entitled to compensation if we follow the same model in across the water, right?
Right.
So, but 100% of NIE customers would be asked by an extra charge in their bill. They wouldn't be asked, they'd be told, it would be put on their bill to pay more, to pay for those people who are entitled to the compo. And he reckons, he said this morning, it would be a charge somewhere, an extra charge somewhere between £7 and £15.
Well, even £7 and £15 for a pensioner or a person on a low income, that's a hell of a lot out of their budget. Now, these shareholders of Power NIE and the top fat chests, as they call them, they're well able to pay that, right? But the ordinary person that is on benefits or trying to bring up a young family, it's hard on them. When the price of gas and the price of oil went up, Power NIE put their prices up straight away. When it came down, they were very slow in taking the prices down a minute bit.
Well, look, if you listen back to what the NIE top brass were saying when they were giving radio interviews, that managing director guy, Mr. Hines, he was saying that about looking at a model similar to across the water. The regulator pointing out to us that the model, if it is the model across the water, is that you all pay for the compensation. NIE doesn't. Now, we've had our first and deputy first minister yesterday calling for NIE to pay out. Are they doing that in the context of expecting everybody else to pay for it? Emma Little-Pengelly and Michelle O'Neill. And we've been in touch with them, we've been in touch with our office, and we're waiting for them to respond. Would you be happy paying?
But why should the 100% of the people in Northern Ireland have to pay for the compensation? As Power NIE's lines, I know it's a
storm. if you want the same model as across the water, that's what it is.
Yeah, but sure, I don't know. I'm not paying any of it. It's just plain and simple like that.
Well, you wouldn't have a choice.
I withhold £25 every time.
It's not £25, £7 to £15.
Now, £7 to £15, I'd be withholding that all the time. I pay my electric in advance. When my bill comes in, I'm always in advance, right? I don't have a keypad meter, I have an ordinary meter. Now, to me, I live on a pension. That's going to be an all wee bite of my pension.
Well, let's see how it shakes down. Let's see what Stormont specifically are asking for. Let's see if NIE, when they're talking about looking at models similar to across the water, are they looking at the exact model across the water where we all pay for the compensation? They don't. That's why the regulator's interview this morning has been so interesting. If you want to listen back to it, it'll be on BBC Sounds straight after this programme. Austin, thank you very much indeed. Now, next, if you're travelling, change of tone this morning, something light. If you're travelling, do you think there should be a dress code for passengers? Spirit Airlines in the States has stated that a guest shall have to adhere to a dress code before getting on their plane. They won't be permitted to board the aircraft if they're barefoot, inadequately clothed. How does that mean? Well, they've defined some of it includes clothing deemed as see-through, lewd or offensive clothing, or tattoos on show. So you wouldn't be able to get on a flight, a Spirit Airlines flight, if you had a tattoo. Should we make an effort to dress better when travelling? I've been speaking to the commentator, frequent flyer, Andrew McVeigh, and the tailor and businessman, Chris Souter. I began by asking Chris what he thinks of the idea.
Yeah, I'm sort of with them, Stephen. Obviously, you know, with what I do,
I
would love people to really dress up to go on planes. Remember, like it used to be in the 50s and 60s, where air travel was so romantic.
Are you for real?
People get dressed up and maybe got their suit, shirt, and tie on.
To get on a plane.
Fly, go, I just fly across the world and just realize, you know, that old concert, you're on a plane and it's something high end. And yeah, I'd love people to dress up. But now, obviously, Stephen, I know this Spirit Airlines, they're not going for that kind of old tailored look. They're just kind of saying, guys, you know, have a bit of decorum, have a bit of respect.
Decorum.
Put your stuff away.
I'm just back from California, right?
Yeah.
And I do this every time I'm getting on a plane. I have a wee pair of shorts under my tracksuit bottoms. The tracksuit bottoms come off as soon as I get on that plane. My shoes come off and my socks come off.
Awful.
Well, what are you talking about? Because if I'm on a 10-hour flight, I don't care. I don't care how I look to some type of snob like you. I care that everything's soft around me.
Think of everybody else, Stephen. Think of the guy sitting beside you smelling your manky feet. That's horrendous. You should be ashamed of yourself, Stephen Nolan. You're trying to keep up opinions over here that we're lovely, nice, respectable people here in Northern Ireland. I don't want you flying across the world, one of our top guys like Stephen Nolan not wearing any clothes down below that.
No, I'm wearing shorts.
I know, but Stephen, like, I presume with all your money, because you're so wealthy, I presume you fly business class when you're flying across.
I do fly business, but I fly business not because I've got a couple of quid. I fly business because I'm fat.
No, I don't know, but I think you fly because you're
imagine 10 hours with your thighs scraping against some other man's hairy thighs. No.
But again, Stephen, like with business class.
Brendan here behind the scenes is screaming yes, but I'm saying no.
It should be business class. You know, it should be smart. I know Qatar Airways, I know a lot of the bigger airliners actually make you wear a smart dress when you're going business class.
Ridiculous.
Do they frown upon you, Stephen? Do you see, like, do the air hostesses, do they frown upon you the way you dress yourself?
Andrea?
Well, I mean, this is fascinating. I've a whole new world has been open to this sort of the Stephen Nolan way of traveling.
I can't get it out of my head, Andrea. It's stuck in my head and I hit Maggie feet rubbing over somebody else's plane.
I think I've got a picture, actually, but anyway.
But I thought, Stephen, I thought you were such a gentleman and you were so dapper. I'm very surprised at this. But
I've never been known as dapper in my life.
I think people should dress comfortably for flying. And
yes.
I do agree with the other guy, because when my mother-in-law emigrated to Malaysia back in the 50s, I think it was, she says that she wore, you know, a hat and gloves on her best clothes. Like, the very idea of doing that. Now, you have to be comfortable. You're going to get in. It's a tiny seat.
It's ludicrous.
It's grubby. You're going to spill some of that food down you. I mean, I get out of flights and I put my clothes away and I don't wear them again until the flight back because I feel so grubby. Now, you have to be comfortable, Stephen, but that does not include taking your socks and shoes off. That is just
if you are on, you're essentially going to bed or sitting in a chair for 10 hours. Like, and you want me all dapper.
Other people. I think you should dress for comfort. I'm just surprised at some of the things that you said. And this airline.
Absolutely, I do it every time.
This airline is from Florida, so I wonder, is this, you know, anything to do with people in Florida? But no see-through clothing?
No, of course not. You don't want any of that malarkey. But putting on comfortable clothes, like a pair of shorts so that, you know, you're you know what I mean. It's much more comfortable than an all hard pair of trousers. I'm just about fitting into the seat, for goodness sake.
I do think people should be comfortable,
yes,
definitely.
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, you don't agree. You're putting looks first.
No, but hold on. You see, I agree, Stephen, because if your clothes are properly tailored and they're made from they're made from better quality materials, you see, it is very comfortable, Stephen. In fact, I could dress you up in a beautiful smart shirt and tie that would be very comfortable.
Uh-huh, just a bit. You want to dress me in a suit to get on a plane?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Fly the flag for Belfast. Fly the paper. This is how we do it over here.
I will let you both into a little secret. And this is a true story, no matter whether he denies it or not. Chris Buckler from Good Morning Ulster, when he is flying to America, wait for this, he wears pyjamas.
Oh my goodness.
I'm telling you, he does. Now, the pyjamas are handed out by the airline, but that's what he does. No socks, no shoes, Buckler's on those planes with pyjamas.
But is that the business? Yeah. Is that like the high end business class?
Well, come on, he's posh, isn't he? He's posh and he works for Gamuy. What do you mean?
Well, I think like if the airline are giving him the pajamas and he's wearing them in their business class, you know, the part of the Stephen, I've never flown business class, so I don't. I've only seen this on the internet. I need you to take me on holiday. So I've only seen that they give you pajamas. Is this correct? The airline actually gives you like branded pajamas to wear when you're sleeping, but do they then expect you, whenever you're not sleeping, to get back changed into your normal, nice, smart attire then? Is that the way it works?
I don't care what they expect. I care about me being... I don't care about any other customer being irritated by me not having a nice shirt and tie on. Like, clear off. It's 2025.
But we need to bring those old days back, Stephen. That's what I'm trying to say. We need to get back to that way of... Yes, on a plane. Nice, respectful social construct, nice dress, where we're really respecting where we are and the fact that we're on a plane and we're lucky to be on a plane and we're flying across. And yeah, I think we should be really dressing up a little bit. Now, Stephen, see, to be fair to the Swift Airlines, I think they went a wee bit too far with the tattoo thing, because like, there's so many people out there have tattoos nowadays and it's normal to have tattoos. I don't feel that people need to cover them up, but I do agree with them that the see-through clothing and like the swimwear and the bathing wear, like, you have to agree with me. You can't be doing that in a plane.
No, I don't agree with you. But I wear shorts, as I've said. You know, this expands to other environments. You know, if you go like that, Andrea, about, you know, wearing smart clothing, should you be required to do it in work? Because that has all deformalised as well. Like, sometimes I come into the BBC and I'll pair a pair of tracksuit bottoms, I'll pair dirty trainers.
I know, it's horrendous.
But should
Chris
I be...
Butler wears pajamas to work? I mean, that's...
No, he wears them on the plane. He wears them on the plane. He can do that all at once, it's true. But you know, should you be coming into work in a shirt and
well,
tie?
Well, I think it depends on the job. And you definitely, these days, you're right, people don't dress up too much, but we have to be comfortable. And a lot of those things that maybe women wore, heels and, you know, dresses, tight dresses, anything like that, it's so uncomfortable. You have to be able to move around freely and to do your job. But I think it also depends on status and position. If you're the managing director, if you're the boss, you want to dress smarter because you get more respect. So, you know, it depends.
Yeah, Stephen, I don't know, I didn't get to do this, I think it was it Simpson? Who was it last week? Anyway, we were talking about Edwin. Did you see Edwin put the speaker, give off at some of our MLAs about their dress? Did you see that one?
I did. I saw that when I was, where was I? I was in Palm Springs and I saw Pootsie, the speaker, Mr. Poots, Speaker Poots, calling for better dress.
Yeah, and like I was commenting on that, Stephen, and I totally agree with him.
Because, well, do you?
Yeah, because my angle was that government isn't casual. Running our country should not be casual, so it should not be treated as such. So the people that are maybe dressing down should have a wee bit of pee put on them to try and dress themselves.
Do you know what?
Bit.
I haven't been here to have that discussion. We can certainly have it now. Is it not more important for MLAs to look like the people they're representing, and not everybody runs around in a shirt and tie?
Yeah, well, no, that's, I suppose there's an argument, but I'm just thinking for social contracts, even the way we are as humans, the way we are as people, there are levels of dress for levels of positions within society.
Well, exactly, and there are. Yeah, exactly, there are. And maybe we shouldn't just categorise everybody in a certain position in society to be looking a certain way.
But again, it's just a construct, isn't it, Stephen? It's just what we're, it's what we're known to. It's what we're known for.
Maybe brave people break constructs.
I know, but then where do you stop? Where do you stop with that? You know, there needs to be rules of some description. Because do you stop brushing your teeth in the morning then? Do you stop combing your hair? Do you know, this is where you start getting down a rabbit hole where all of a sudden you lose all flipping social construct, and all of a sudden the place just turns into anarchy.
But you've mentioned you've mentioned Stormont. So let's run with that, Andrea, now as well. Like, what's wrong with someone going into Stormont and representing the people, wearing what many people wear during their daily lives? Just a jumper, a shirt, a t-shirt, a pair of jeans. What's wrong with that?
Well, because it's, as he said, it's a serious... Being in government is a serious job, as is being a surgeon and being a doctor or anything like that. It's a serious
job. So you're not serious
job.
Now, depending on what you wear.
Well, no, I think you have to treat it with respect and Agreed. Show that you're serious about it. So it's that sort of idea of respect. If you go in jeans or tracksuit bottoms or shorts, I don't think you respect the position. And it's a very important job, and you have to respect the authority and the influence and the status and the position that you've been given by the voters to do that job, to act on their behalf.
But the voters don't run around in shirts and ties all day at work. The voters include...
The voters aren't in government.
Yeah, but hold on a minute. The voters include plumbers that'll be running around. They can't wear shirts and ties all day because they'll be getting dirty. They'll be on their hands and knees down fixing pipes. They include, you know, people, hairdressers that need to wear, you know, soft shoes and things because they're standing on their feet all day. Butchers, people out digging roads, workmen, workwomen. You know, you're suddenly saying that politicians should look completely different from many of the people who they represent. I need to get Poots on this programme to explain his thinking around this, Souter.
Well, Stephen, for me, it's just, again, it's about uniform. You actually made the point, I think, for us. All those previous people that you spoke to all have a set uniform for their job. Your plumber wears a pair of overalls to carry his tools. Your nurse wears a nice nurse's uniform. You know who they are. So for me, whenever you're at a position of power within our government particularly, you should be dressed appropriately. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is in our I keep using this term, our social construct. It's just what we all know, that those in positions of power should be smartly dressed. The ladies should be smartly dressed. The men should be smartly dressed. Now, one thing I did say, Stephen, it doesn't always have to be a shirt and tie. You can dress nice and smartly with a roll neck or a three-button polo, but it's generally jacket and a trouser, jacket and chino. What we don't want to see is guys turning up to Stormont wearing a pair of ripped jeans and a T-shirt with something written across. You know, there has to be levels of respect, Stephen, in the country and particularly within government. As I said before, it's not casual, so it shouldn't be treated as such.
Have you any idea the amount of dingbats that there are in powerful positions in society who they're nicely coiffed hair and their lovely iron shirt and tie and suit is basically a cover for how stupid they are? But in all different parts of society.
I don't know how to reply to
but
that.
But it's true, isn't it? Is it not about what the person represents, what their values are, rather than how they look? Like, I've had this in my life. It was a long, long time ago on the BBC. Somebody said to me, oh, you're too fat for TV. Well, I kind of proved that wrong. I'm not exactly a model-like. And, I do many different visual television shows. That's my personal experience. I just wonder all this stuff of, you've got to look this homogenous, finely tuned, chiseled way. Tell that to Zuckerberg. One of the most powerful people in the world. Who I haven't seen him in a suit.
But I'm sure whenever he goes to a particular business meeting, he probably wears a suit, Stephen. I can't actually stop it here. On that note, you wear a suit. See, when you do the TV, I see Stephen Nolan in a suit.
You do.
You're doing it too.
Maybe
and again, that's where you probably feel more. It probably just gives you that little bit of extra oomph to say, right, look, I'm in my suit now. I'm going on the TV. I look good. This is what you're supposed to wear. Let's go.
There are times I do Nolan Live, and this is true.
Yeah.
That sometimes you don't see under the desk where I'm wearing a pair of shorts and no shoes.
What about your white denim jacket, though, Stephen? I would love you to do Nolan Live in that white denim jacket.
Have you seen that denim jacket, Andrew?
Brendan loves it.
I haven't seen the denim jacket, though.
It's a white one. It's a wee white one. All right. Interesting conversation. Let's see what people at home think this morning. 030-30-80-55-55. Thank you, Andrea. Thank you, Souter.
Thank you, Stephen.
Morning, Andrea. Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. Right, Big Barbara in Lisburn, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. I hope you missed me.
I missed you terrible.
Good.
Because I didn't listen to anybody, only you.
Well, come on. You got to be loyal to Rainy Ulster.
Before we get off, listen, you're talking about your wearing shorts and all on the plane.
Yes, absolutely, 100%.
Well, would I tell you, if you were sitting beside me, I wouldn't care you were sitting on your underwear.
Well, I might.
Well, I wouldn't care because you're doing your own comfort, Stephen.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because it goes beyond planes. And you've got Speaker Poots now. You've got Edwin. And he's talking about a particular dress sense. And there will be many people who will support him in that and say, well, look, you know, that you've got to dress maybe for respect for the institution.
Uh-huh.
But why not dress like the people who you represent dress? And that is not just the suit-clad workforce. That what about those people who, you know, they're in dungarees, they're in jeans, they're in work clothes all day. Why can't they see politicians in their place of democracy, Stormont, dressed like them?
No, Steve, you just dress the way you want. And I say, if ever you're on a plane, I'd love to be sitting beside you and I wouldn't care you were sitting in your boxer shorts.
Well, I might. Imagine being stuck beside you for 10 hours.
Well, that would be great. I'd be able to see your leg.
My goodness. Thank you, Barbara. Are you doing all right?
No, I'm for the hospital today and I'm for the hospital next week again
and for the hospital
the week after that again.
Oh, for goodness sake. Well, I'm glad to look at your at least a smile on your face when you're talking to us, Barbara.
All right. You keep
a smile
in my face, Steve. You keep going. But before I go, what do you think the one that got the MBE?
Who?
Hugo.
Oh, Hugo. It's fantastic. It's fantastic.
It's great, wasn't it?
Absolutely fantastic.
I thought you might have been a bit jealous.
I tell you what, I'll never get one.
You never know now.
Listen, I don't think I'm friends with anybody in authority, but I'm happy that way.
Oh, don't worry. I'll get you one someday.
Thank you, Barbara.
Still here.
Morning to you. Thank you. Robert, not Robert the taxi driver, surely not.
Oh, yes. Mr. Nolan, he's back.
Good morning.
The main man's back. How are you doing, Mr. Nolan? Did you enjoy yourself?
I loved it. Do you know what? I love America. It's an interesting place at the minute with Trump, obviously. But I missed my mum. I missed my friends here, all of that kind of stuff. I missed the Nolan team. They're telling me in my ear. It's always nice coming home, Robert. That's the thing.
It is, Stephen. There's no place like home, Stephen, no matter how far you're away.
So what do you make of this whole dress malarkey? Should you wear a shirt and a tie when you're driving the taxi, don't you?
You see, Stephen, you know, when you're dealing with the public, you know, like political figures are meeting the public all the time, whether walking into Stormont, walking out, they're political representatives and they should be, it's just a good example. Especially with the big salaries they get, you know, they can well afford to have a shirt and tie on and a nice pair of trousers.
Yeah, but
and a nice
why?
Pair of shoes.
But why?
Because they're public representatives.
But
they're
why?
Meeting the public at all times.
But why can't you be dressed casually and be just as good when you're meeting a public representative? What is this about a shirt, a tie, and a suit?
I've always had a shirt and tie on. I always like the. You know, people say to me, you're well dressed as a taxi driver. And I always say, well, truthfully and honestly, I dress out of charity shops. You know, and if a political figure has found it a bit difficult and they can't make their way in their big salaries, you know, they could adopt the attitude of taxi drivers and go to charity shops.
Is that what you do?
Surely it is. I'm not ashamed to say it, yeah. I've been dressing out of charity shops for years. Years, they all know me in the charity shops. They all know my sizes.
And do you get good gear?
Yeah, well, I'm as better dressed as anybody. I don't have to be near Chris to be, you know what I mean? I'd have to work 24 hours a day to get a suit out of his place.
Out of suitors?
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely. You know what? I can dress, briefly, Stephen, for about 15, 20 quid.
Wow.
And that's the truth.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's not overly. And honestly, from occasions, people, the public say to me, you're well dressed. You know, you're very dapper as a taxi driver. And I always tell them straight up front, I dress out of charity shops.
Mm-hmm. All right.
There you go, Mr. Nolan.
Robert, I was Nolan. You couldn't see me when I was interviewing the regulator this morning, but I'm in a Laguna Beach top.
I wouldn't surprise me, but you're not meeting the public. You're in a close.
Well, I was meeting the regulator. The regulator was sitting opposite me. John French was in a suit and a tie and a wee shirt.
Well, it's up to John French to say, Stephen, come on, wake up and smell the coffee and dress like me.
Yes, absolutely.
Look, Stephen, also going to say, great to hear you're back. You know, the biggest show in the country. I reckon there's about another 50 years in the year. It's not going to be 4 years new like Donald. You know, I think Stephen's going to be in that BBC for till he's about 90.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. You're not retiring, Stephen. I'm a taxi driver, Stephen. I've taxied all my life. People say to me, are you going to retire? You know what I tell them, Stephen? See, when I go below the ground, that's when I retire.
Thank you, Robert. Morning to you. Morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. Programme's available on BBC Sounds. If you want to go back and listen to any of the shows, and we'll see you in the morning at 9 o'clock. Thank you, everyone. Keep well until tomorrow. In the
country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.